nations hacking from the outside. Via an anonymous portal controlled by his headquarters near Moscow, he logged on to one of his dummy social media accounts. From there, he leapfrogged over to a benign photographer's profile, scrolled back through the correct number of posts, and liked an obscure photo. With that, his contact would know that he had received the phone call and was online. Tretyakov stroked the manicured beard that covered his lean face. He had prominent cheekbones, dark receding hair, and dark brown, almost black eyes. Gifts from his ancestors, who had migrated from Kalmyk steppe. Though he stood 6 feet tall, people sometimes said he bore a similarity to the much shorter Vladimir Lenin, also of Kalmyk descent. Lenin had died at 53. Tretyakov was now 52 and had no plans to follow the great revolutionary leader and founder of the Soviet Union in an untimely demise. He had many more years of useful service to render to his country. Throughout his career, he'd been an adept recruiter and runner of spies, but he had made his true mark in the realm of subversion, sabotage, and special operations. The son of an accomplished father who had taught applied mathematics at Moscow State University, and a mother who had taught piano at the Moscow Conservatory, he had been a child prodigy. He was skilled in both mathematics and music, but had no desire to follow either path. When spotted by a university professor paid to be on the lookout for potential GRU recruits, he had jumped at the chance. The idea of being of value to the powerful Russian military appealed to him. Being recruited to work with their famed intelligence unit was beyond any dream he had ever had for himself. He had visions of fast cars, beautiful women, and James Bond-style assignments. The reality couldn't have been any more different. His training had been brutal. Not only was it physically demanding, it was also psychologically merciless. The instructors were sadists who took pleasure in abusing the cadets. One cadet ended up hanging himself in the barrack shower, and it was Tretyakov who found him. He had never seen a dead body before and stood there for several minutes staring at it, the tongue protruding purplish-black from between blue lips, a bloody froth oozing from the nostrils and saliva dripping from the mouth. The cadet's member was erect and his trousers had been soiled. The sight should have repulsed him, but it didn't. He felt a mixture of fascination and contempt. The cadet had not only been defeated, but had allowed himself to be defeated to such an extent that he had willingly given up his own life as a result. Tretyakov first respected and then grew to covet that kind of power over another human being. The pursuit of it propelled him upward through the ranks of the GRU. With each new promotion and each new posting, he accumulated more. It was like a drug. The more he tasted, the more he wanted. Now, as the GRU chief of covert operations for Eastern Europe, Tretyakov was at the pinnacle of his career and his power. That made the middle-of-the-night call all the more disturbing. Transept was the most important assignment he had ever been entrusted with. If it failed, at best his career would be over. He didn't want to think about what might happen at worst. There were only two things of which he was certain. If he failed, he would not only get the blame, but would also not be around to argue in his own defense. The GRU, like the KGB's successor, the FSB, had a way of permanently distancing its mistakes. Tretyakov didn't want to be a mistake. He believed in his mission. He was its author and wanted it to be a success. It was why he had taken such painstaking care over every detail, no matter how small. He knew how easily things could go bad. Pouring a cup of coffee, he waited a few more moments and then entered the encrypted chat room. Though he was concerned, he wanted to maintain the appearance of confidence and control. Showing up too quickly might suggest that he was worried. His contact was already there, and Tretyakov had been right. The news was bad. Very bad. The Norwegian cell had been eliminated. all of them. The news was devastating and would not be received well in Moscow. He needed to figure out what had happened and then what to do about it. At the very least, the remaining cells needed to be put on notice. There could be no mistakes, not one. The fate of the entire operation was in their hands. Chapter 10. United Nations, New York City. Thursday afternoon. The consultation chamber was a smaller, less opulent meeting room than the one most people saw on television. It had a narrow U-shaped table in the center and glass windows running down the walls, behind which headset-wearing interpreters sat and carried out their duties. The 15-member Security Council was having a heated discussion about the drafting of a joint statement. A series of mass graves had recently been discovered in Syria. Russia wanted to go easy on the response. U.S. Ambassador Rebecca Strum, a tall, tough brunette in her late 40s, wasn't having any of it. "The United States will not agree to soften the language," she said, in reply to the Russian request. "Absolutely not." The Russian envoy put on his most charming smile. "Surely words matter to the United States." "Truth matters to the United States."
"Perhaps," offered the French ambassador, "we can change some of the words without changing the spirit of the statement. How does that sound?"
"It sounds like more game playing to me," Strum answered. "The Syrian regime must be held to account. Along with men, those graves were filled with women and children. The United States intends to paint this atrocity in the most vivid terms possible. The world must know."
The Chinese envoy threw up his hands. "We will be here all day. Let us finish this statement and get on with our other business already."
She looked at him and quipped, "It is so unusual to see the Chinese ambassador agreeing with the Russian ambassador, especially when it comes to Syria." The diplomat bristled at the remark, but let it slide. He had tangled with Strum before, and it hadn't gone well. She was like a bear in a pit. If you climbed in with her, you might make it back out, but not without suffering tremendous damage. He had fulfilled his promise to his colleague. He had said his piece. It was up to the Russian envoy to convince the Americans to change the language. Still smiling, the Russian tried once more.
"We don't know yet, with complete certitude, who was responsible for these deaths. This is all the more reason for us to carefully craft our response."
Strum was about to respond when one of her aides stepped up behind her and whispered something in her ear. Gathering her things, she stood.
"Where are you going?" the Russian ambassador asked.
The U.S. ambassador motioned for her deputy to take her seat.
"Ladies and gentlemen, please excuse me. I will be back as soon as I can. Thank you."
Turning, Strum headed for the door and exited the consultations chamber alone. Down the hall was a cafe known as the UN Delegates Lounge. Here, United Nations diplomats and staff could meet and chat casually over coffee. The Americans, French, and British had nicknamed it the Russian Cafe for the secret bottle of vodka kept under the bar. Throughout the day, members of the Russian delegation would pop in, speakeasy style, to fill nondescript containers with the spirit before rejoining the current meeting or proceeding to their next. Off to the side, she saw the people she was looking for. Seated at the table were the ambassadors for Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia. All three stood as she approached.
"Thank you. Please sit," said Strum as she joined them. "I have bad news, and none of you are going to like it."
Across the room was Russia's deputy permanent representative to the UN for political affairs. He was within sight, but out of earshot. As he sat sipping his morning coffee, he couldn't help but notice the meeting. Strum was doing most of the talking, but it was obvious that her table mates were not happy. In fact, the Baltic ambassadors looked deeply concerned. One was so angry that after jabbing his finger at her, he stood and stormed out of the lounge. Something was afoot, and he took careful mental notes. Any strife between NATO members was always of interest to Moscow. NATO was the only enemy Russia worked as hard to undermine as it did the United States. He waited for the meeting to end, and once it did, returned to his office and began typing up his notes. His superiors were going to have a very interesting report to send to Moscow. Chapter 11. Washington, D.C. Thursday evening. The five-star Ristorante La Perla in Georgetown was known for some of the best Italian cuisine in the city. In addition to being walking distance from Embassy Row, it was also open until almost midnight. It was the perfect spot for a clandestine dinner that wasn't supposed to appear clandestine. As Lydia Ryan walked in carrying a Brooks Brothers shopping bag, her guest was already waiting for her. He sat at a table in the back, facing the front. Knowing his commitment to tradecraft, she figured he had arrived at least 20 minutes early, checked everything out, and then, given his proclivity for alcohol, had begun drinking. Artur Kopecz worked under official cover at the Polish embassy for the Agencja Wywiadu, Poland's foreign intelligence service. He had been at the spy game for decades, and he looked it. His fair hair had gone white long ago. He carried a spare tire around his middle, the product of spending too much time behind a desk running spies, rather than just getting out and running. His red-rimmed eyes were milky with the onset of cataracts, likely sped up by a two-pack-a-day smoking habit. The end of his large nose was a sea of broken capillaries, brought on by his alcoholism. He had high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and symptoms indicative of the onset of diabetes. He also had a doctor whom he paid handsomely to keep all his medical issues out of his file and off the radar screen of his superiors. What they didn't know wouldn't hurt them. He had plenty of years of service left in him. The Pole watched as Ryan entered the restaurant. How such a tall, gorgeous woman had evaded marriage for so long, especially in a town like D.C., was a mystery to him. If he had been 20 years younger, he might have considered making a play for her. As it was, he was not only old enough to be her father, but he was dangerously close to grandfather territory. He stood to greet her.
"Hello, Artur," she said, smiling. "Thank you for meeting me."
"Of course," he replied, kissing her on both cheeks and then pulling out her chair.
"It's been too long." "I know. I've been busy. I'm sorry."
He returned a gentle smile as he sat down.
"Completely understandable. How is he?"
Ryan sighed as she placed her napkin in her lap.
"Not well."
"I was afraid of that. I tried to call him not too long ago. They told me he had been moved."
"He's in hospice. According to the doctors, he has less than 6 months."
Kopecz shook his head.
"My God, such a shame."
Ryan nodded solemnly.
"Did he ever tell you the story of how we first met?"
he asked, a smile coming to his face as he tried to buoy her mood.
"He did," she replied.
Leaning down, she removed a wrapped parcel from the shopping bag and handed it to him.
"This is for you."
The Pole, who had just picked up his glass, looked at it for a moment and asked,
"What is this?"
"Open it,"
Ryan encouraged. Setting his glass down, he accepted the package and peeled away the brown paper. It was a framed set of handwritten notes from one of the most dangerous operations Reed Carlton and Artur Kopecz had ever undertaken together. In the run-up to the first Gulf War, 6 American intelligence operatives, sent to spy on Iraqi troop movements, became trapped in Kuwait and Baghdad, and the U.S. had to put out the call for help. The United States asked for assistance from multiple countries, including Great Britain, France, and even the Soviet Union. Only Poland had stepped up and agreed to help get the Americans out. The operation was dubbed Operation Simoom, and Carlton and Kopecz were sent in to coordinate everything that would take place on the ground. Because of Poland's extensive construction and engineering contracts in the region, it was uniquely positioned to help smuggle the Americans out. All six were issued Polish passports and then integrated into various construction camps and work groups. Somehow, though, Iraq intelligence had caught wind that something was going on with the Poles and the Americans. There were many dramatic twists and turns. The operation almost collapsed multiple times. Even as they attempted to sneak the Americans over the border, they encountered an Iraqi checkpoint where one of the officers, who had spent time in Poland and spoke Polish, wanted to interrogate the Americans. It seemed that no matter what the old man and Kopech did, the deck was stacked against them, yet they never gave up. Not only did they get the six intelligence operatives out safely, but the Americans brought with them secret maps and detailed notes critical to the planning of Operation Desert Storm. One of those critical pieces of intelligence was what Kopech now held, framed in his hands. A small, engraved plaque, centered in the bottom of the frame, gave the date and location of that final border crossing. It was representative of the kinds of gifts that often passed between teammates and allies. As soon as Kopech realized what he was looking at, he smiled.
"I thought you would appreciate it," said Ryan. "And I know he would have wanted you to have it."
"Thank you. Where did you find it?"
"Since he was moved to hospice, I've been going through all his personal papers."
"It was lovely of you to frame this for me," said Kopech, as he waved the waitress over. "But something tells me this isn't why you wanted to see me."
Ryan hesitated for a moment, visibly struggling to find the right words. Finally, she said,
"I don't know how else to put this. We have a problem. I need your help."
Chapter 12.
"By we, do you mean you and Reed?" asked Kopech,
after the waitress had left their table with their order. Ryan shook her head.
"I'm talking about the United States."
"Whatever you need, consider it done."
"It's not a small problem."
Once more, the Pole smiled.
"In our line of work, it never is."
"Artur, on behalf of the United States, we need your help. We can't involve the Polish government."
"Now things are getting interesting. Why don't you tell me what it is we're talking about?"
"As part of our NATO partnership, the United States has been pre-positioning certain military equipment in Central Europe."
"Tanks, Humvees, and other items. We know this. What's the problem?"
Ryan took a deep breath.
"There are some things we've been storing that you don't know about."
"Such as?"
"I'm not at liberty to say."
The Pole laughed.
"I can't help you, Lydia, if I don't know what it is you need."
"Yesterday, a U.S. Army transport was robbed in Poland."
"Robbed? In Poland? What are you talking about? Where?"
"Just outside Warsaw," said Ryan. "The soldiers had been traveling from their base in Zagon in western Poland and had pulled off at a truck stop for a break."
"And?"
asked Kopech.
"The lot was crowded, and they didn't park line of sight. They thought their trucks would be safe. But while they were inside, one of the vehicles was broken into, and a theft occurred."
They paused as the waitress brought Kopech another vodka, and Ryan a glass of Sancerre.
"What was taken?" he asked after the waitress had left.
"Six crates."
"Six crates of what?"
Ryan demurred. When she failed to answer his question, he asked,
"Am I supposed to guess?"
"For the record, the soldiers had no idea what they were transporting. The crates had been purposely mislabeled and the paperwork altered."
Kopech took a sip of his drink and leaned forward.
"Now you absolutely have my attention."
"The equipment in question never should have been delivered to Poland. Somebody screwed up."
"What are we talking about?"
Again, Ryan hesitated.
"Lydia, ask any of my ex-wives. I'm a terrible mind reader."
"Upgrade kits for BGM-109G missiles."
Kopech laughed, quietly at first, and then his laugh grew louder. Ryan looked around, concerned that he was drawing attention. Catching his breath, the Polish intel officer shook his head. Also known as the Griffin, the BGM-109G was an American ground-launched cruise missile capable of carrying multiple types of warheads, including nuclear. It had long been outlawed under the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty with the Russians.
"What you're saying is impossible," he chuckled. "There aren't any Griffins in Europe. There aren't even any Griffins in America. They were all destroyed under the terms of the INF Treaty."
After another look around the restaurant, Ryan leaned forward.
"No, they weren't."
Kopech was shocked by her admission.
"Do you realize what you're saying?"
It was a rhetorical question. She didn't need to answer.
"How many of them are in Europe?" he asked.
"I can't discuss that."
"Fine. Let's back up. Are there any in Poland?"
She shook her head.
"No."
"The ones that are in Europe, where are they located?"
"Artur, you know I can't discuss that either."
Kopech laughed once more.
"If you want my help, you have to work with me, Lydia. How about this? How many trucks were there?"
She took a sip of her wine, using the time to weigh what she should tell him.
"Three,"
she replied.
"Now we're getting somewhere. What was their destination? Where exactly were they headed?"
Reluctantly, she divulged the information.
"The Baltics."
"Can you be more precise?"
"Deliveries were scheduled for Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia."
The Pole let out a slow, slightly boozy whistle.
"If the Russians find out, they're going to lose their minds."
"We obviously don't want that to happen. The missiles are simply an insurance policy."
"Insurance against what?"
"Russian incursion."
"Incursion where?"
"Anywhere under NATO protection. If push comes to shove, we won't hesitate to use Griffins."
"Is there something going on that I don't know about?" Kopech asked, concerned. "Is the United States or NATO anticipating some sort of hostile action by Russia?"
"Concern is running very high, the highest it has been since the Cold War. And Russia hasn't exactly been doing anything to lower that concern."
"What do you mean?"
Ryan rolled her eyes and took another sip of wine.
"So many provocative acts. How much time do you have?"
"As much time as you need," the Pole replied.
He wasn't kidding. In fact, his tone was dead serious. In no particular order, Ryan went down the list.
"The annexation of Crimea, continued military operations in eastern Ukraine, repeated violations of U.S. and NATO airspace, the use of a nerve agent to assassinate a former Russian intelligence operative on U.K. soil, and the buildup of Russian troops and equipment in its western district, as well as in Russia's client state of Belarus, both of which are right on NATO's doorstep."
"We've been monitoring it too," said Kopech. "Russia, though, claims they're simply pre-positioning in advance of a new wargaming exercise."
"A previously unscheduled wargaming exercise."
The Pole shrugged.
"They're a sovereign nation. They can schedule snap military exercises. They have done it before. It doesn't necessarily mean they're preparing for an invasion."
"Is that what Poland believes?"
"Poland's position is Ronald Reagan's famous position. Trust, but verify."
"Well, any trust Russia may have enjoyed with the United States has been swept away by their own actions. The current position of American intelligence, unfortunately, is to distrust first and work tirelessly to verify."
"That's not only unfortunate, but it's extremely dangerous," said Kopech. "In such an unstable climate, there's less margin for error. War becomes much more possible."
"I agree," she replied. "I wish it weren't so, but that is where we are."
"So, back to the business at hand," he said, pinching the bridge of his nose. If you cannot discuss how many missiles there are, let's talk about the number of road mobile launchers.
Ryan shook her head. I cannot comment on that either.
Kopech understood that she was limited in what she could divulge. The key lay in coming up with the right questions.
What about warheads? Are any of them nuclear-tipped?
Once again, the look on her face said it all. Jackpot.
Jesus, Lydia, he muttered. No wonder you don't want my government involved. What kind of yield are we talking about?
I can't go into detail.
I'm going to need something. Are they strategic or tactical? How about that?
She was slow to answer. They were on very dangerous ground.
From what I understand, said Ryan, they're tactical. Low yield, if that makes any difference or makes you feel any better.
Not really.
Kopech knew that the presence of smaller, low-yield battlefield nukes only meant they were more likely to get used. And once tactical nukes were in play, the larger, much more devastating strategic nukes were only a step away.
Artur, if this gets out, understand that the United States is going to deny any knowledge.
They can deny it all they want, but if even one of your upgrade kits turns up on Polish television or in one of our newspapers, you'll be in a bad spot.
Which is why I'm asking for your help, she replied.
The car park where the robbery took place has CCTV cameras. Do you have people back in Poland you trust? Someone you can put on this? The man thought for a moment, and then nodded. Pressing forward with the toe of her beige pump, she slid the blue and gold Brooks Brothers bag nearer to Kopech.
I think I got your size right. You can keep the shirt. The file's underneath.
What about expenses? I may need to spread some money around.
How much?
$10,000 for starters. If this is some low-level criminal operation stealing from parked cars, I may not even need it.
And if it's something else?
I may need more. Possibly a lot more.
She understood.
You'll provide me with an account?
Kopech removed a tiny pen and a small pad of paper from his jacket pocket. Writing down a bank name and a series of numbers, he tore off the page, folded it in half, and slid it across the table. With that part of their business, for the moment, complete, he turned back to the subject of Lydia's boss. Raising his glass, he offered a toast.
To Reed Carlton, a fine intelligence officer, and an even finer gentleman.
They clinked glasses and drank. A silence then fell over the table. An accomplished intelligence officer herself, Ryan knew better than to move to fill it. Eventually, it was Kopech who spoke.
I'd like to see him, spend some time with him before he passes.
She had expected the request. In fact, she had rehearsed her response. Even so, she spoke her next words carefully. If the Polish spy runner sensed anything was off, it would be the end of everything. Chapter 13. Hainaut Province, Belgium. Friday. Harvath and his team had set up shop in a semi-restored 17th century fortified chateau. It didn't look much like a chateau to him. It looked more like an elongated three-story farmhouse surrounded by a high stone wall. The property was at the end of a gravel road in the Belgian countryside, halfway between Brussels South Airport and Charleroi, and NATO's Supreme Headquarters Allied Powers Europe, SHAPE, in Mons.
What is this place? Yashinsky asked as they approached.
It's a rental, said Harvath. Belongs to a Belgian businessman. He was transferred to Thailand with his family. We found it online.
As their car neared the gates, two serious-looking men materialized on the other side. After confirming the driver was Harvath, they unfastened the lock and opened the gates so the vehicle could enter. Though they were wearing jackets,
Yashinsky had no doubt they were armed. Both had earpieces.
"Pool boy and the gardener?" she asked.
Harvath smiled as he drove forward into the motor court and parked. Getting out of the car, he introduced the two men.
"Monica Yashinsky, I'd like you to meet Jack Gage and Matt Morrison."
Gage, who looked to be in his 40s, was an enormous man. He stood 6'3" with a thick, dark beard and had a wad of chewing tobacco in his mouth. Morrison was a few inches shorter and several years younger. He looked to be in his early 30s and stood about 5'11". He offered his hand first and Monica shook it, followed by Gage's. When he extended his hand, she could see a paperback novel tucked inside his coat.
"What are you reading?" she asked.
"The Terminal List. It's a thriller by a guy named Jack Carr," Gage answered.
"Any good?"
"Considering the author is a former SEAL and can even string his sentences together, it's amazing." Out of the corner of her eye, Monica saw Harvath raise his middle finger and use it to massage his left temple. There appeared to be a little inter-service rivalry going on here.
"Let me guess," she said. "Your army?"
Gage nodded. "Was 5th Special Forces Group." "Which makes the fact that he can read even more amazing," jibed Morrison. That got a laugh out of Yashinsky.
"And you?"
she asked. "United States Marine Corps," he replied with an Alabama drawl. "Recon." "Where the motto is," said Gage, "when you can't dazzle them with brilliance, just riddle them with bullets." Yashinsky laughed again.
"You don't have to laugh," Harvath deadpanned,
though it was pleasant to see her smile for the first time.
"Their jokes aren't that good."
In unison, both Gage and Morrison raised a middle finger and began massaging their temples. Harvath shook his head.
"Are you two joining us for lunch?"
"We couldn't get a reservation," replied Morrison.
"Sorry to hear that."
"Don't be," offered Gage. "Your chef's a little too temperamental for my taste." Harvath shook his head once more as he led Yashinsky away from the car. In addition to the main structure, there was a garage and a small stone guest house. She was studying its tiny windows when the door opened, and an equally tiny man, accompanied by two enormous white dogs, stepped out.
"Who's that?"
"That's my secret weapon," said Harvath. "Come on, I'll introduce you."
The moment the two dogs saw Harvath, they began wagging their tails. They never left the little man's side, though, until he whispered some sort of command, and they raced forward.
5 minutes or 5 months, stated Harvath, scratching them behind the ears. It's always the same welcome.
I'm beginning to believe they like you more than me, said the little man,
as his small boots crunched across the gravel motor court. He couldn't have been more than 3 feet tall. His salt and pepper hair was long enough to be swept back behind his ears. He had a neatly trimmed beard and wore jeans and an Irish fisherman's sweater.
Nicholas,
he offered, sticking his hand up so she could shake it.
Pleased to meet you, replied Yashinsky, bending down. I'm Monica. Are you hungry, Monica?
I am.
Good, because lunch is ready. Let's go inside.
When Harvath had called her for lunch, this wasn't what she had expected. They had each left Norway the same way they had arrived, separately. NATO had arranged for her to hop a ride on a military transport. Harvath had remained behind for a day with Carl Pedersen. He wanted to see what, if anything, the Norwegian forensics team pulled from the ashes of the cabin. It turned out to be a bust. As Harvath was a special consultant to SHAPE, Yashinsky had assumed he and anyone working with him would have been issued offices on the Mons campus. Stepping into the guest house, she realized these were his offices. The building had low ceilings with exposed timber beams. Taped to the plaster walls were countless maps, photographs, and computer-printed documents. There was a large whiteboard with notes in multiple colors of dry erase marker. Makeshift desks held rugged laptops or keyboards and large monitors. In the corner stood a rack of hard drives. Multiple muted flat-panel television sets were tuned to different 24-hour news channels. This wasn't a domicile. It was a control center. And at that moment, she knew her hunch was correct about who the little man was. The troll was infamous in intelligence circles. He was a purveyor of highly sensitive, often classified information. He bought it, sold it, traded it, and stole it. He had an amazing list of clients around the world and an equally amazing list of enemies. The intel he trafficked in had been used to disrupt covert operations, blackmail politicians, and bring down governments.
"You're the..." she began.
"Not anymore," he replied, cutting her off as he climbed onto a step stool to reach the stove in the open kitchen, the smells from which were delicious.
"Now, I'm just Nicholas."
"You're working with the Americans?"
"I am an American," he beamed. "Recently minted."
"I give up," she said.
"I don't understand any of this."
"Don't worry," said Nicholas, as he lifted the lids off several pots and pans and began plating their lunch.
"It will eventually make sense."
"Or it won't," said Harvath, as he examined a new photograph that had been added to the wall. Yashinsky lowered her voice.
"Is he always like that?" "Like what?" "Such an asshole."
The little man smiled.
"He's just testing you."
"For what?"
"He doesn't like people who blindly follow orders. He wants you to think for yourself, to think outside the box." "Don't worry. He's a teddy bear."
"I heard that," Harvath replied from the living room. The little man smiled at her, and, nodding at the plates, asked for her to help in carrying everything out to the table. He then encouraged Harvath and Yashinsky to sit while he fished a bottle of white burgundy out of the fridge.
"I actually found a very nice 2014, he said, bringing the bottle over and handing it to Harvath along with a corkscrew.
Harvath looked at his watch. As long as they didn't open a second, they'd be okay. It might also help to further take the edge off Yashinsky. He had decided to read her in, and a lot of it was going to come as a shock. Chapter 14. For a man of such small stature, Nicholas's appetites far outstripped his size. One of his most troubling predilections, at least from a security standpoint, had been Nicholas's appetite for women. Because of his primordial dwarfism, he had been accustomed to paying for sex, and not just any kind of sex. As with his passion for food, the little man had been a gourmand in the realm of exotic sexual practices. The pool within which he could fish for the right professionals was quite limited. Eventually, one of his enemies had discovered the highly secretive service he employed. An assassin was dispatched, and Nicholas had almost died. Those days, though, were behind him. An intriguing woman named Nina had become a permanent fixture in his life. She understood not only who he now was, but also why. Once his adversary, Scott Harvath, had become Nicholas's friend. He had realized his talents and had given him an opportunity to go from international fugitive to being one of the key players of his team. Even Reed Carlton, who had been highly suspicious, eventually grew to trust and respect him. In fact, it was Carlton who had convinced the President of the United States to pardon his past offenses and make him a citizen. For the first time since his parents had abandoned him at a brothel, Nicholas had the one thing he had always wished for: people who cared for him, and a semblance of an actual family. As Harvath poured, the little man explained what he had prepared. The wine was from France, but everything else was classic Belgian. There was tomate crevette, ham and endive gratin, and sole meuniere. Before they dug in, Yashinsky had a question. Ever since she had entered the guest house, music had been playing. It sounded familiar, and she thought she recognized the artist.
"Have we been listening to George Clinton and Parliament Funkadelic this whole time?"
Nicholas looked at Harvath and grinned.
"I like her. A lot."
Both men were fans of funk music in general, and George Clinton and Parliament Funkadelic in particular. The fact that Yashinsky recognized what they were listening to said a lot about her. Good taste in music wasn't easy to come by. As they ate, they made small talk. Harvath hoped to bond with her and get to know her better. In order to facilitate a conversation, he opened up, a little. Referring to the back and forth that had taken place at the gate, she asked about his military background. Harvath explained that he had been a Navy SEAL. When she asked which team, he told her,
"I started at Team 2 and ended up at Team 6. They now call it Development Group, or DevGru for short."
He described how he had caught the attention of the Secret Service and had worked for the White House, after which he gradually moved into the role he was now in.
"As a consultant," she repeated, the skepticism evident in her voice.
"If it flies, floats, or fights, chances are I have consulted on it," he replied with a smile, taking a sip of his wine.
There was something devilish about him. He reminded her of someone from her past, someone she had loved very much, someone who had been taken from her way too soon. She glanced at his left hand again, as she had when they'd first met, and there was still no ring, but that didn't necessarily mean anything. Plenty of operators removed their wedding bands when they were away on assignments.
"Let's stop playing games," she said. "You've been holding out on me. I want to know what's going on."
He smiled. She was the right choice for this job. Her intelligence and her instincts were excellent. Leaning back in his chair, Harvath picked up a folder from the credenza behind him and set it on the table. Opening it, he removed three photographs and slid them toward her.
"Do you recognize these?"
Yashinsky looked at them and nodded.
"They're crime scene photos from the attacks on the NATO diplomats in Portugal, Spain, and Greece. In Lisbon, a high-powered rifle was used. In Madrid, a rather sophisticated car bomb. And in Thessaloniki, a .45-caliber handgun was fired by a passenger on the back of a motorcycle."
"Correct," said Harvath. "The victims all worked for NATO, and all the attacks happened in NATO countries. What else did they have in common?"
She thought for a moment. "Allegedly, they were carried out by the same organization, some new terrorist group called the People's Revolutionary Front."
"Exactly," said Harvath. "Except the PRF isn't real."
"What?" asked Yashinsky, confused.
"The People's Revolutionary Front is all made up. It isn't real."
"I don't understand."
"It's a two-pronged attack against NATO. The first part involves the attack themselves. They're meant to create an internal panic and drain NATO resources as SHAPE moves to secure all their diplomats and facilities while simultaneously hunting down the perpetrators. Then, there's the propaganda component. With each attack, the PRF puts out a gratuitous statement describing NATO as an imperialist organization, propped up by global corporations, committed to war, conquest, and profiteering, among a host of other false charges. Each attack gets them even more news coverage. On the internet, armies of trolls and bots repeat the lies. They attack anyone with a pro-NATO stance. They put out fake news stories to amplify their message to appear like they are part of a broad international movement. Their goal is to throw NATO into chaos and to cause the citizens of its member countries to question the organization's ultimate value."
She was stunned.
"But to what end?" she asked.
"To prevent NATO from effectively responding to an invasion."
"By whom?"
Harvath took a long pause before responding.
"Russia."
Yashinsky couldn't believe it.
"You're telling me Russia is behind the attacks on our diplomats?"
Harvath nodded.
"And the attempted sabotage of American military equipment in Norway?"
He nodded again.
"How can you be so sure?"
He looked at her.
"Because I personally put the bag over the head of the Russian embassy official who provided this information."
Chapter 15. "Wait," she said.
"You kidnapped a Russian embassy official?"
"Technically, he was Russian military intelligence."
"GRU?"
she asked, using the popular acronym for the main intelligence directorate of the General Staff of the Russian Army, Russia's largest and most secretive foreign intelligence service. He nodded once more.
"Colonel Viktor Sergin. He was operating as Russia's military attaché to Germany, out of their embassy in Berlin."
"And so you just snatched him off the street?"
No, from his apartment.
I can't believe I'm hearing this.
Believe it.
Yashinsky shook her head. There's no way NATO condones something like that.
I wasn't working for NATO at the time, he stated.
Then whom were you working for?
I'm not at liberty to say.
Yashinsky shook her head again. He was exasperating. All the subterfuge, all the doublespeak.
I'm going to go out on a limb and assume it was for the United States. I'm going to go even further out on that same limb and assume it probably involved more consulting, right?
She drew the word consulting out as if it was some sort of slur. Harvath let her get it out of her system. He knew what was in her file. He knew she hated the Russians just as much as he did, if not more. She also believed in the rule of law, as did he. But she wasn't yet at the point where she was willing to bend one to beat the other.
By the way, she continued, what does consulting even mean? That the law doesn't apply to you? That you can do whatever you want, wherever you want, whenever you want, all in the name of winning? Is that what consulting is?
He waited to make sure she was finished, and then asked,
do you remember the bombings in Turkey a little while ago? One of which killed the U.S. Secretary of Defense, along with several members of his staff as well as his protection detail? Or the female suicide bomber, who hopped the fence and detonated at the entrance to the White House?
Of course.
Those were Sergin. He trained and dispatched the terrorists responsible. There were other attacks on Americans as well. Suffice it to say, we felt justified in grabbing him.
Where is he now?
In a very deep, very dark hole.
From which, of course, he's not free to leave, she commented.
That's the problem with holes, Harvath remarked. Some are so deep that you can't get out of them.
Yashinsky paused. Her head was spinning. She didn't know what to say. He was all but admitting that the United States was still running its rendition program, a program globally condemned, and one that the USA had long since claimed to have shut down. She had several questions, but she wasn't sure she wanted the answers.
Fuck, she thought. Why had she agreed to this assignment?
Harvath could not only tank her career, he could also land her in prison. No one could just flout international laws the way he was.
I'm not comfortable with this, she said.
Well, you need to get comfortable, he replied, because this is the way it is, Monica. We fight here, on these terms, right now, or the entire continent of Europe becomes a battlefield. Poland, Germany, France, all of it.
What are you talking about?
Harvath reached for the tiny copper kettle Nicholas had brought out at the end of the meal and poured himself a strong cup of Turkish coffee. The more time he spent with Monica, the more he liked her. She was the next wave. She would help steer her country and NATO going forward. She just didn't know it yet. Soon, he hoped, she would. He just needed more time to get her there.
We interrogated Victor Sergin for months, said Harvath. He had been involved in a lot of different things during his career with the GRU. One of the more interesting things we learned was a rumor he had overheard at headquarters in Moscow.
A rumor about what? She asked.
Russia's plan to invade the Baltics.
She was visibly taken aback. He was talking about Poland's neighbors.
The Baltics?
She replied.
When?
We don't know, he stated, taking a sip of coffee.
What about how they plan to invade?
We don't know that either.
What the hell do you know then?
She exclaimed, exasperated. Harvath focused on what, at the moment, he thought she should know.
According to Sergin, the GRU was charged with paving the way for the invasion. In addition to a full-blown propaganda campaign, they had activated what the old-time Soviets called useful idiots, disenfranchised nationals in NATO countries with certain political and world views, who were susceptible to influence. They based the PRF on the Marxist-Leninist terror groups of the 1970s, similar to the Red Brigades. Once promising individuals were spotted and assessed, they were recruited and indoctrinated. Then they were brought to Russia and trained in paramilitary tactics, weapons, explosives, and guerrilla warfare. After that, they were sent home and told to await further instructions. Sergin didn't have all the details.
but he warned that once attacks on NATO personnel, equipment, or installations started happening by the so-called PRF, that was our sign that Russia was preparing to move on the Baltics. So, we basically know the PRF is a distraction. Is that it? We have no clue where they'll strike next or when, and no timetable for the Russian invasion of the Baltics? Harbath nodded. Yashinsky dropped her napkin down on the table and stood. Pacing, she tried to figure it all out. Nicholas cleared the dishes as Harbath watched her. He was pleased to see her so worked up, so passionate. If she could control that, channel it, she might just exceed his expectations. It took Yashinsky a moment to process everything. Finally, she turned and asked, "How did you know about Norway?" "The equipment we keep hidden in those caves needs to be serviced," he replied. "As part of our agreement with Norway, we hire Norwegians to do it. Whoever works in the caves has to have a background check. And because of the importance of that equipment, we routinely review the personnel files, as do our counterparts in Norwegian intelligence. 2 weeks ago, there was a red flag, and an investigation was opened. That investigation uncovered a plot to bomb the caves and destroy the equipment. When we learned that the saboteurs were all going to be at the cabin, the decision was made to move in and capture them. Obviously, everyone wishes there had been more time for reconnaissance."
"Obviously," said Yashinsky.
"What's also obvious is that you took Sergen's rumors seriously." "Only when the attack in Lisbon happened, then our antennas went up. Then, once the attack in Madrid took place, we had a high level of confidence that we knew what was happening."
"A confidence that you never shared with NATO. In fact, you didn't do anything until your equipment was targeted."
"Wrong," corrected Harbath. "We looped in the Supreme Allied Commander from the start."
That was a piece of the puzzle she hadn't been aware of.
"Then why didn't he do something?"
"Communiques were sent to all NATO personnel after the first attack. Everyone was warned. You know that."
"But the communiques didn't contain all of the information. I saw them. None of us knew what you knew."
Harbath shook his head. "It wouldn't have made a difference."
"You don't know that," she pushed back. Harbath could see the deaths weighing on her.
"Maybe the diplomats wouldn't have been able to do anything with it," she pressed, "but on the intelligence side, it could have helped the investigation. Maybe I could have done something with it."
"There's nothing you could have done."
"You don't know that."
"Maybe. But we couldn't risk it."
"Why not?"
"Because NATO is shot through with Russian spies," said Harbath. "It has been since the beginning. That's its greatest weakness. It's like Swiss fucking cheese. For every Russian you uncover, there are two more hiding somewhere else. We couldn't risk their learning what we know."
Monica looked at him defiantly.
"How do you know I'm not a spy?" she demanded.
"To be honest, I don't."
She glared at him. "Then why am I here?"
It was a fair question, but one that he wasn't going to answer, at least not fully, and certainly not yet.
"Because the powers that be want my team working with someone from SHAPE," he said. "And that someone is you."
"What powers that be? The Defense Intelligence Agency? The Central Intelligence Agency? Who do you work for? And don't tell me again that you were sent by SACT. You don't work for NATO. And him," she added, pointing at Nicholas, "he definitely doesn't work for NATO."
Though Harbath had no idea why, he glanced at his little friend. For his part, Nicholas simply shrugged as he set down three dessert plates, each with a piece of makowiec, a traditional Polish poppy seed pastry cake, normally served at the holidays. He knew well enough to stay out of this. Harbath was on his own.
"Our job is to represent the interests of the United States government," Harbath stated.
"So which interests would those be?" she asked.
He thought for a moment.
"Anything related to the North Atlantic Treaty."
He was still lying. She could sense it and pressed further.
"What's your objective?"
This time, there wasn't a pause. Harbath replied immediately.
"Per the treaty, to promote stability and well-being in the North Atlantic area."
"How, precisely?"
"By doing everything in our power to prevent an Article 5, he stated. "To make absolutely certain that the United States and its armed forces aren't dragged into war. any war, no matter what it takes. At that moment, everything clicked for her.
Chapter 16. Yashinsky was intimately familiar with Article 5. She could practically recite it by heart. It was the cornerstone of the NATO treaty. The parties agree that an armed attack against one or more of them in Europe or North America shall be considered an attack against them all, and consequently, they agree that, if such an armed attack occurs, each of them, in exercise of the right of individual or collective self-defense, recognized by Article 51 of the Charter of the United Nations, will assist the party or parties so attacked by taking forthwith, individually and in concert with the other parties, such action as it deems necessary, including the use of armed force, to restore and maintain the security of the North Atlantic area. She had been wrong about Harvath and his involvement. This wasn't simply about American military equipment. This was about the American military. Out of 29 NATO countries, only 6, the United States, the United Kingdom, Greece, Romania, Poland, and Estonia, were annually expending their required 2% of GDP on defense. In light of what she now knew about Russia, it was no wonder the United States had been so angry about the other 23 members not living up to their military spending agreements. That went double for Lithuania and Latvia, 2 of the 3 Baltic countries which were sitting right on Russia's doorstep. America's debt was in the tens of trillions of dollars and had exploded since the September 11th attacks. Its annual deficits were also out of control. Its budgets showed no signs of balancing. Would the United States willingly incur even more debt to go to war in the Baltics? After nearly 2 decades in Afghanistan, 8 years in Iraq, and multiple years spent chasing ISIS in Syria, would Americans agree to expend additional blood and treasure to defend the tiny Baltic countries of Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia? Could a majority of Americans even find those nations on a map? Or had Americans had enough? And what about Poland, she thought. Poland was an exceptional partner to the United States. It had met its NATO spending requirements and was a staunch U.S. ally. But if Poland were attacked, would Americans see it as far away and inconsequential as the other Baltic nations? Would the United States honor its commitments and come to Poland's defense? Yashinsky wanted to believe America would, but if she had to be honest, she wasn't 100% sure. She was even less sure about the United States defending the Baltics. Though she hated to think it, she could envision a scenario in which America sat things out. Via fake news and information warfare, she could imagine a fervor being whipped up where Americans might be swayed to believe it was better to let nations like Poland, Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia fall rather than have the U.S. go to war with Russia on their behalf. It had happened before. She had studied it while at the National Defense University. In 1938, Hitler annexed Austria. Instead of coming to Austria's defense, the rest of the world did nothing. Emboldened, Hitler then pressed for and was awarded a strategic chunk of Czechoslovakia, populated by ethnic Germans, referred to as Sudetenland. The Europeans, hoping to slake Hitler's thirst and avoid a Europe-wide war, agreed to trade away the sovereign territory of Czechoslovakia for a false peace and empty promises. Winston Churchill had seen it for the folly it was, and had sent a strong warning to his countrymen as well as the Americans. His words were so chilling to her that she had committed them to memory. "And do not suppose that this is the end. This is only the beginning of the reckoning. This is only the first sip, the first foretaste of a bitter cup, which will be proffered to us year by year, unless by a supreme recovery of moral health and martial vigor, we arise again and take our stand for freedom as in the olden time." Things moved quickly downhill from there. In March of 1939, Hitler took the rest of Czechoslovakia and annexed a slice of Lithuania. On September 1st of that same year, the Nazis invaded Poland. 2 days later, Britain and France declared war on Germany. 2 weeks after that,
the Soviet Red Army invaded Poland from the east. On September 27, 1939, Warsaw surrendered to Germany. It would take 50 more years for Poland to fully recapture its freedom. And while history didn't necessarily repeat, it did rhyme. What was now making sense to Yashinsky was that with its invasion of Ukraine and the annexation of the Crimean Peninsula,